That is a powerful story, and love what Brooke and Sean shared. Good morning, everyone. If we've not met, my name is Steve Carter, and it's good to be back here at Faith Bridge. I love what God is doing and stirring in this church. And if you need a Bible, we're going to be walking through an entire chapter. Just feel free to raise your hand. And every time I come to Faith Bridge, it always takes me back to when I was a middle school pastor in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because we thought it'd be a great idea for the junior high students to do this. Except when Fran and Ethel raised their hand and a Bible was flying through the row, we got bounced from that volunteer job. The other thing I love about it, too, is in the early 2000s, there was a person named Little John. And if you know Little John, that's why you're in church. And if you don't, you're holy. But we would do this thing where we would say, hey, turn with me to Matthew chapter 6. And then all the students would yell, oh, what? And then I would say, turn with me into Matthew chapter 6. Okay. And it was awesome. It was just like very bizarre, especially if a guest teacher came. And so we had middle school ministry on Tuesday nights. And then Sunday mornings, probably 6-8 times a year, they let me preach. And I would get up and, hey, turn with me to Joshua chapter 1, and all 500 middle school students would like stand up and yell, oh, what? And it would always embarrass me. They're like, what's this young man teaching our kids about John, the gospel writer, and Little John? All right. Well, I loved last weekend's message that Pastor Ken taught us, and he walked us through an incredible, incredible message. If you were like me, it made you kind of look back at some of the gifts that you were given from your family of origin and also some of the pain points. And he offered up kind of these three phrases. He said that we have to acknowledge. We have to acknowledge the wounds that have come from our family. People always ask me, how do you know you're a good parent? And I say, I know I'm a good parent when my kids go to counseling for different reasons than I go. I didn't pass down the same stuff that was given to me, but I'm surely going to give them something. But you have to acknowledge that. And then he talked about surrender and surrendering our life to the grace and the peace that comes from Christ alone. And that's so beautiful. And when you can acknowledge and you can surrender, then you kind of wake up to this reality that you, me, we, as Christ followers, are part of a new community. And one of my most favorite insights that Pastor Ken shared last week was when he took us all the way to the end of the Bible in Revelation. And he talked about how we will all receive this new robe, this white robe to be walking, this kind of picture of holiness, that we have been cleansed, that we are the bride, the church, this new community. Well, Joseph, in chapter 39, he has found himself not in a cistern anymore, but actually sold into slavery. And we're going to look at a very, very familiar passage. But if you can just go with me, I'm going to try and look at this passage from maybe a different way and try to connect some dots at the very end. Genesis chapter 39, verse 1. I know some of you wanted to scream, what? Well done controlling yourself. Verse 1 says this, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in the eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate, spoken like a true man. Now, what I love about this is you kind of see that Joseph, who continually finds himself in some really, really difficult circumstances and yet has this trust in God, and God pours out favor on him when it doesn't seem like it's gonna happen. And often when it does happen, you'll see it through the scriptures, it's through the way that he works. And I think sometimes work gets a bad rap. I think sometimes the idea of an occupation, we kind of rank and say, oh, this person's job is better than this job. But did you know that in the scriptures, 5,433 times, the concept of work and occupation is mentioned in the Bible? More than words like prayer and love combined. There's more mentions of occupation and work. And if you think about this, you think about how if you were the God of the universe and you were gonna start the book that actually details who you are, wouldn't you come out of the gate saying, I am God, omnipotent, omniscient, all the omni words, that is me. I am awesome. You can't look at me. I am holier, holier, holier. I can make, like, wouldn't you come out of the gate, like, just with a bunch of humble brag, like, just trying to let everyone know who you are? But that's not how God does it. Genesis 1 begins with God rolling up his sleeves, entering into the chaos, and getting to work, and bringing order to the chaos. Even getting down to the ground and actually taking and forming Adam, which literally is where we get the name Adam, which literally means dirt man. And like from the dirt actually creates life. This is God. He's a worker. And I think what we have to see is God actually cares about his work. And he not only just works, but then he entrusts the work to each and every one of us. And so work has something to say about our discipleship, our formation in Christ. But I don't think we often think about it like that. I think for many of us, you know, we wake up in the morning and we read our Bible and maybe we journal, or maybe there's some other spiritual practice we do, like make coffee. But like we have a moment where we try to say, oh, I'm filling my heart, I'm filling my mind, I'm filling my soul. But that's not actually where discipleship is tried out and tried on. If you think about it, Dallas Willard, one of my favorite thought leaders, says this, because discipleship is a matter of learning to live. Being a student of a rabbi, Jesus, is about learning to live. And discipleship is a matter of our whole life. Its primary place is where we live, our home and our work. So what you have to understand here is that every time you step into the marketplace, or every time you step into your home, every time you walk out of the kitchen or the boardroom, this is an invitation for your formation, because we spend most of our lives at home or at work. So let's actually talk about what work is. Nancy Ortberg defines work as the creation of good in our world. I love that. Anytime that you are offering up good, bringing order to the chaos, that's work. And there is good work for every single one of us to do. And I think about this, because if work is a place of like primary formation, well, then I think we have to ask ourselves, how am I being shaped and formed? Because work can shape, form, and reveal so much about your spiritual well-being. Have you ever thought about this? You go into work and you're like, you've just spent time with the Lord, but then you walk in and you're like, ah, just so stressed. What does that say about our spiritual well-being? You find yourself super bitter. What does it say about our spiritual well-being? Like the environment of work can shape us for better and for worse, can form us for better or for worse, can reveal for better for us our spiritual well-being. And you know how God most often does that? It's through your coworkers. It's not only just work, but your coworkers can shape, form, and reveal so much about your spiritual well-being. Do you have anybody that you work with that when they talk, you're like, stop talking? You don't ever say that out loud, but you think it. Or like when one person speaks, you just start to sin in your brain with cynicism, you know, and sarcasm. And if you don't, then probably someone's doing that about you when you speak, you know? But I think it's really, really important, because when all of a sudden that happens, what does that reveal about us? Why is it that person gets under my skin? Why is it when that boss doesn't follow through, does it frustrate me? And again, it invites us back to that posture that Pastor Ginn taught us last week, where we get to acknowledge. You got to acknowledge that. You got to surrender to that reality. And then remember, oh, yeah. We are a part of a new community. There's a new way of formation, a new way of shaping that happens. But Joseph finds himself in a unique seat. And many of us know this story, but I want us to see it in a different light. This time, he finds himself having the chance to be shaped and formed, something to be revealed, when he ends up being in his boss's home. Look what it says. Now Joseph was well built and handsome, like Ryan Gosling. That's what my version says. Honestly, I probably spent 3 hours this past week looking through old Vanderbilt University yearbooks and just an Asbury Seminary yearbooks, trying to find an epic 20-something picture of Pastor Ken, because I had this vision. I was just going to read this, and it was just going to pop up on the stage, on the screen. That would have been awesome, but Google, you let me down. All right, verse 7 says this, and after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. Oh, someone's like, ooh, well, we're just getting real here. Yes, okay, keep going. This is this. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. So this amazing opportunity for Joseph, in power, leading, and all of a sudden this woman, Potiphar's wife, sees him and desires him. And what's incredible is some scholars say that anyone who worked really, really close to Pharaoh, who wasn't a child or descendant of Pharaoh, basically had to castrate themselves as a sign of loyalty, that you weren't going to try to overtake Pharaoh's role. And so many scholars actually believe that Potiphar had castrated himself. If you don't know what that means, just email ken.wordling@faithbridge.org. Now, what's incredible, though, now if you're married to Potiphar, there's a void of something in your marriage. And then all of a sudden, here comes Joseph, who's young, stunning, strapping young man, and this woman begins to pursue him. And all of a sudden, if you watch this, again, work and your coworkers have this ability to shape and form and reveal about your well-being, but it's almost as if Joseph starts to go, I can't do this because my master has trusted me. And I can't do this because he's given me power over everything except you, because you are his wife. And then the next line he says is, and why would I do such a thing, not just towards you and not just towards my master, but to God? And it's the perspective, the perspective in the face of temptation that Joseph rises. And I think it's fascinating. And this reminds me of something that I often will talk about, the spiritual importance of playing it out. When I was in college, a couple of my friends were married early on. And we were going out, and there's about 8, 9, 10 of us around a table. And my buddy, who's a dear friend, and he and his wife and their young little child. And then a couple other friends, myself, Sarah, who I'm now married to, but was trying to date at that time. But we're all around this table, but I am watching my friend not really interact with his wife, but starting to really have this, energy between this other lady, like, on the other side of the table. And there's laughing, and there's giggling, and there's little inside jokes. And I watch my buddy go to the restroom, and I just get up, and I follow him. And I'm like, hey, bro, play it out. He's like, what do you mean? Play it out. He's like, what are you talking? Play it out. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, hey, I know you, and I know that girl, and I know you. That there's some energy going on there. And he's like, no, it's not nothing at all, nothing at all, nothing at all. And unfortunately, in 3 months, it was something. And I think about playing it out because I love to fly fish. Anybody like to fly fish? I'm terrible at it, but I love to do it. They call it the contemplative's recreation, and you're always trying to trick the trout. So every few minutes, you're changing the fly or the lure, and you kind of cast, and it's amazing. I think in my entire life, I've caught 3 fish. So I'm terrible at it, but it's so peaceful, and I just feel so good. And I just think about this. If I were to cast this perfect fly, and it's just kind of hanging on the top of the water, and it's sort of bouncing, and all of a sudden this like massive rainbow trout sees it and begins to swim up to it. And as it's about to swim up to it, his buddy goes, don't do it, play it out. And the rainbow trout's like, what? It's a fly, it's right there. He said, no, play it out. What do you mean? Well, you're gonna bite that. And you think it's a fly, but there's a hook that's gonna go right through your gum. And then there's gonna be a 7-year-old who cares nothing about you on the other end. And they're just gonna yank you and pull you. Your gums are gonna be bleeding. And after 4.5 minutes, the kid is gonna basically bring you up and you're out of the water. You're struggling to breathe, and the kid's gonna try to yank you off the hook and can't, and then they're gonna get help, and then all of a sudden the kid's gonna hold you and stand as his mom, his grandma, his dad, his grandpa, his aunt all take the same picture and post it to various Instagram accounts. And then they're gonna bring you and open up a cooler, and it's a bed of ice. The same kind of ice that where kidneys get put in and stolen, like you're gonna get put in that. They're gonna close it. And then for the next, 2 hours, you're gonna sit on a bed of ice. And then during those 2 hours, you're gonna meet more of your friends who are also gonna join you. And then at the end of it, they're gonna bring this boat, they're gonna put it onto a trailer that's connected to a big truck, and they're gonna drive you, and you're gonna be in this ice, and the ice is just gonna be moving and moving and grooving and moving, and then you're gonna pull up to this house, and you're gonna smell something you've never smelled before. Smell of what they call charcoal. And it's gonna be amazing. And there's gonna be this charcoal fire. And you're gonna think, wow, that actually smells pretty good. But before you get close to that fire, you see the largest knife you've ever seen and a cutting board. And they literally cut you in half. And then there's the smell of this green stuff called guacamole and pico de gallo and corn tortillas and rice and beans and chips. And you're thinking to yourself, wow, this is fascinating. And then what they do is they put you in a bunch of breaded goodness, and then they put you on this grill, and you are burning in hell. And you are sitting here going, what is going on? And then that 7-year-old eats you. How good does that bait look like to you now? See, when you find yourself playing it out, you can look at the temptation and you can ask yourself, if I were to do this, where will it lead? What kind of collateral damage would that bring to my family, to my soul, to my work, to my career? What is it worth it? And the more that you can like actually look out and play it out, then you can literally tell desire, because desire is a real thing and not all desire is bad desire, but you can actually, unlike an animal, actually control your desires. And this is the wild piece, is the way that we talk about desires. We, you know, animals were created before us, humans. We think about it often is even the way that we talk about, you know, she's such a cougar, like he's a tiger. Like we're like use all of these animalistic language words. And the truth is, what ends up happening is we go backwards in the story. But what it means to be fully human is that you actually can name your desire, but your desire doesn't control you. And this is what Joseph is able to do. He is not denying that this woman's beautiful, but he's like, it's not worth wrecking my relationship with Potiphar and really hurting my relationship with God. And his work is what actually creates the moment to shape, form, and reveal. But this is where it gets even crazier. And this Joseph guy, man, I don't know how he survived. It says this, verse 11, one day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She, being Potiphar's wife, caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Real quick, I think from this moment on, Joseph stopped wearing robes and cloaks altogether. So my dad gives me a robe, I find myself getting thrown into a cistern, get sold into slavery. Now I'm wearing a robe, and all of a sudden the Potiphar's wife is ripping it off me. I think he just went from this day on shirtless. I think he was just like, I don't care. Get me as far away from a cloak as possible. But you're going to see the writer. The writer's just going to drop the word cloak again and again and again. Look what it says, verse 13. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him the story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Now, I think this is fascinating because you see this. Joseph gets thrown into a cistern, gets sold into slavery, and yet he trusts God, and God gives him influence. And then an unfair story is brought forth about him, and all of a sudden he gets thrown into prison, and yet he trusts God. And God is with him, and God gives him favor. The one verse that pretty much sums up Joseph's life is, what was meant to harm, God used for good. And this is a true story for every single one of us. Because we are going to experience stuff that is unfair, that is unjust, that is not right. But here is the difference. Most of us see the circumstances, the unfair, the unjust, the not okay. And we see that as how God thinks and feels about us, or how we think and feel about God. We use it as an excuse. And Joseph had every right to do that. He could have been like, well, man, these guys are supposed to be like the leaders and they do this. Or, man, this false story, God, where are you in this? But he continued to not let the circumstances dictate how he felt about God and how he thought God felt about him. What about you? And in the matter of your work is an incredible opportunity. Because your work, it shapes, it forms, it reveals your spiritual well-being. But your work and your coworkers shape and form and reveal about your spiritual well-being.
But also, even deeper than that, work can shape, form, and reveal so much about your spiritual intimacy with God. And when I think of intimacy, one of the best definitions I've ever heard is, into me you see. Like letting God into me, I'm giving you access to see all of the parts of me, the defensive parts, the justice parts, the parts that want to escape, the parts that are afraid, the parts that are like image management, the protector parts, all of these parts of us, when you have that spiritual intimacy and you get close to a coworker, or you find yourself in a situation or a circumstance of temptation, or you find yourself in an environment where it's shaping and forming, revealing, what do you do with those parts? And when you can begin to recognize that your workplace, the marketplace, your home is one of the most primary ways that you can actually partner with God and become everything He created and intended you to be. So here's the real question. Are you co-creating with God to bring good into your workplace? I mean, I think for so many people, they downplay what they do. I just work retail. No, you don't. Like, you actually see people. You actually do something that's really, really important. I just work in the food industry. No, you don't just work in the food industry. You are master of hospitality. You are showcasing what people can experience and the power of what can happen around a table. I just work in oil. Well, you just make the world go round in so many ways. I'm a lawyer. Please create good in what you do. I'm a doctor. I'm a car salesman. I'm a teacher. I'm a mother. I'm a stay-at-home dad. All of this is an invitation to partner with God, to co-create good in this world and in the workplace. Don't downplay what you do. And the ancient kind of New Testament church and the understanding of it was this idea of the priesthood of all believers. Meaning, yes, the priests worked the temple, but that everybody should see themselves as a priest, as an elder, as a bishop, or overseer, or pastor. This is what we should like ascribe and hope to become in the local church. And that when we leave this place, because all of this is a practice ground, that when we leave this place and we enter into our homes and the marketplace and our schools and watching our sixth graders sports, which is really, really hard for some of us to do without yelling at the ref. Like what we find is stuff being revealed, and then it's an opportunity for us to bring that before the Lord. Can you just for a moment acknowledge that what you have as a job and what you have as a gift, spiritual gift, talents, opportunities to make money, can you just acknowledge that, man, there is redemptive potential in that? And maybe part of the surrender is actually surrendering that my job doesn't matter. My work doesn't matter. When I would actually teach about this at our church, I would say, you are the priesthood of all believers. And I would ask and invite our church congregation to come to church dressed up in what they would wear on Monday, which was awesome because we had a bunch of FedEx, UPS, and mailmen who showed up. No DHL, but still trying to evangelize. We had people come in suits as lawyers, and we had people come in scrubs as doctors and nurses. And we had people come in like one-piece mechanic gear. Like, it just was awesome. And then we'd have this moment where they all stood, and I just said, hey, you're the pastor. You are an overseer. You are a priesthood of all believers. And every time you work, you get to co-create good in that place. The question is, are you doing it? Are you taking up the rightful space that God has entrusted to you? And that's what it means to be the new community, is that all throughout Cypress and Klein and Spring and the Woodlands and Greater Houston, that this place is becoming a bridge of faith to so many people who have never stepped into this building yet. Yet. But I'll tell you this. This is why this matters. And here's why. Two reasons why I want you to think about it. The first reason is this. Most people look at this ministry guide and they just think about themselves. What do I need right now? And that's a fantastic question. But you know what I really, really respect about this is that if you understood your place in the marketplace as a co-creator of good, as a priesthood of all believing and believers, then you would actually recognize, wow, my coworker just lost their spouse. And it's wild because I haven't known how to go through that and walk well with them through that. But I just saw that we have a grief care group that meets at church on Tuesdays. What if I could make that invitation? Or maybe you have a friend at your work who has a special needs child. And you go, oh my goodness, we have open gates. And this opportunity for these kids to come and be seen and known and loved. Or maybe you have a coworker who has a middle school student. And they have no idea what they're doing. And you're like, you got to come to Faith Bridge because they got this junior high pastor, Dawson, who's incredible. He's incredible. Like they got a community, they got volunteers. But this whole thing becomes a gift of you being aware of what your church, our church, provides, not just for you, but for the greater community. And many people who are here and a part of Faith Bridge, they found themselves being invited into one of these before they ever came to faith. And I just think, man, there's more opportunities for us to see ourselves as pastors and leaders in the marketplace by just making a simple invite. So don't lose sight of this. But the second piece I'd say is this. I don't know, and Danny said it in the video, the announcements video. Christianity is not a solo sport. I don't know anybody who has made it through their faith on their own and finished the race well. I honestly don't. I don't know anyone in my life who has basically said, I'm just gonna go by myself. I don't need community. I don't need help. I'm just gonna do it. I've never seen one of those people finish well. And I think for some of us, if we're gonna be going into some of the greatest formation work on our heart, mind, body, and soul, and it's in our home and in our work, we need to do life together, like Sean and Brooke were talking about. We need to have people in our life who can ask you the hard question, hey, you just got that promotion. What are you really feeling? I feel afraid. I feel a little bit prideful. Or I feel excited. Oh, what are you most scared of? This coworker, I just find myself competing against them. This person. And all of a sudden, when you have that holy space, those grow groups, or a men's group to go talk shop, or a women's group to actually go, a singles group, a young adults group, when you have that, then you realize you're not on your own. And the truth is, if we make it, then I make it. But you can't make it on your own. And so maybe for some of you, you gotta look through this ministry guide and you gotta really just ask yourself honestly, am I going through this season alone? And how's it working for you? And if you wanna acknowledge the truth, you're probably saying it's not the most ideal, which invites you to surrender to that reality. Or in Carrie Underwood theology, Jesus, take the wheel. And when Jesus takes the wheel, you know what he's going to do? He's going to invite you into the new community to be with other people, Christ-minded people to help you grow and become everything you were intended to be. Amen? All right. We're going to kind of transition in the communion service to Pastor Tyler, because he wants to tell you all about this. And for us here in this room, I'm going to invite you just to go to the expo that's right outside the East Auditorium in the atrium. Don't go yet, because I want you to know they got kolaches. Is that how I say it? Cholaches? It's a pig in a blanket that's really, really good. I got great tea. But like, go connect. I walked around in between services and just got to hear and meet and greet and talk. It's unbelievable. It's a great way to find connection. But before you go and get the kolaches, pick up your kids, all right? Pick up your kids. Don't leave them there. It's not great for the volunteers. But would you do this? Would you stand? And I'd love just to give a blessing and prayer over all of you. And would you put your hands out for a blessing? My brothers and sisters of Faith Bridge Church, may you know that you have been uniquely gifted and wired and placed where you are in the marketplace for a reason. I pray that this week you don't let the circumstances of your job, the circumstances of your coworkers, dictate how you feel and think about God and how you think God thinks and feels about you. I pray that you show up and allow the marketplace, allow the school, allow the home to be a great shaper and former and like revealer of where your heart, mind, body, and soul and trust truly is. And I pray that you will let God do what only God can do, which is heal. But I pray that you don't do it alone. And one last thing. Please, this week, Lizzie's gonna hate that I said this, but I love that new worship song. Isn't that a great worship song that we just heard? It was amazing. Worship is an incredible way to learn theology. And there's such great theology in that song. You can go to Spotify, you can go to Apple, wherever music is found, and just look up Faith Bridge Worship. Download that song, blast it, sing it in the car. I mean, just enjoy and delight in the goodness of what's coming out of this church. Amen. I'll see you in the expo. Grace and peace.